Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiT Photo with Catherine Hall and Leo Laporte. Episode 64, recorded July 3rd, 2012. Klaus Herrmann. TWiT Photo is brought to you by Squarespace.com, the fast and easy way to create a high-quality website or blog. For a free trial and 10% off your first purchase on new accounts, go to Squarespace.com and use the offer code TWITPHOTO7. And don't forget, you can now get free domain registration with annual plan subscriptions. It's time for TWiT Photo, the show that covers photography as an art, as a science, as a hobby. And our great photographer, Catherine Hall, and host, is here. Hi, Catherine.
Hey, Leo.
Good to see you. We've got two guests today.
Yes, we do.
Tell me about them.
So we're going to start off with Dirk, and he's been kind enough to stay up till 4 a.m. in Taipei to join us. And he's going to be giving us tips on shooting fireworks.
That's exciting.
Good for getting us ready for tomorrow. And then we're going to have Klaus Herrmann coming on, and so it's going to be a great show.
What kind of shooting does Klaus do?
He does a lot of variety. He does a lot of plants and landscapes and people, kind of all over. So
let's first say hi to Dirk Heindorfer. Hi, Dirk.
Hi, Leo. Hi, Catherine.
Thanks
Hello,
for staying
thanks
up
for
so late.
On.
Is that one of your images behind you right there?
No, I wish it would be, but it's not.
You do specialize, I know, in night photography, so
yes,
you're
that's
perfect.
Correct.
To help us with firework photography tonight.
Yes.
So well, those of us in the U.S. will be... I know you're not celebrating in Taipei, although I think in China, any excuse to set off fireworks. So they probably do it several times a year. But in the U.S., the big firework night is tomorrow night, Independence Day.
Correct. The Chinese invented the fireworks. So right. Here, actually, in a matter of 4 months, we have fireworks every single weekend. So there's a lot to practice, and from that end, a lot to talk about shooting fireworks as well. So let me give a quick run-up, because you can read a lot about how to shoot fireworks, quick tips, and it always goes with the obvious as being this f-stop and this shutter speed, and then the tip is kind of over. So I wanted to share a little unknown secrets when it comes to shooting for fireworks photography. So first is gear. And with gear, obviously, is steady camera, and in that respect, having a tripod. Trying to shoot handheld fireworks, although it is possible in very, very limited circumstances, in order to get good fireworks photos, you need to have a tripod or some steady basement for your camera. And the second one is an essential, is actually a cable release.
So you don't move the camera when you take the shot?
Yeah.
You don't move the camera, and you're actually in complete control on how long your exposure would be, because it's not only about the shutter, it's about setting your camera into bulb mode and then with the press of your finger actually control how long the exposure will be.
Ah, so your bulb mode means that
There's
no set shutter time. When you press the release, the shutter opens, and when
Correct.
You let go, it closes. So you're kind of so what are you looking for? What is the moment that you want to press that release?
Well, that pretty much depends a little bit on the fireworks itself, because there are two types of fireworks that could happen. There is the local ones where kind of one rocket goes off, you have a huge explosion, and then the next rocket goes off.
Right.
In that kind of scenario, you would press the shutter at the minute you hear the sound of the rocket going off. And then you release the shutter the very moment you see that the blooming has been completely gone.
Wow, so you're getting the whole process, the firework going into the air, exploding, then going away. You're getting the entire thing.
That's one possibility.
Okay.
For that, you need to be way far away from the fireworks.
So you can capture it all.
That's for one. And the second is the amount of light.
Uh-huh.
Although you're shooting at night, the actual explosion is very, very bright. So very, very quickly, you have clipped highlights. So as far away you are from the fireworks, the amount of light traveling about the distance, as better end results you will have. So when it comes to shooting fireworks, one thing is very important is kind of your vantage point where you actually take the shot. It's not good to go where everybody is going in order to watch the firework. Because for that, you will be very, very close to the action. You have a lot of people being around you. And what you will end up doing is taking your camera and really look up and kind of shooting above your head. So there will never be getting a photo out of it that would be worth considering a nice photo of a fireworks. So the best point would be something like even 500 meters, even a kilometer away.
Now, what aperture would I want to set if I'm 500 meters or a kilometer away?
Well, you would start of something like, let's say, between f8 and f11.
Because you want to have good depth of field?
Yes, correct.
Yeah.
Pre-focus. You have a certain area where the fireworks is shot. And then you really control it via the shutter speed. The other thing I was mentioning, there were kind of two types of...
We're looking at the second type here. This is from your Google Plus page, the Double 10 firework. This is a whole... This is probably 20 fireworks going off at once.
That photo that you're showing right now,
yeah.
Here, actually the combination out of three photos in total.
Ah, interesting. And by the way, that red part was Lightroom saying you've got blown out highlights down here at the bottom.
And clipping.
Yeah, clipping, right. Yeah. Yeah. But that's okay. That's not a whole lot.
That's so bad when it's that much.
Yeah. So this is a multiple exposures overlaid one on top of another?
Yes, correct. Because this fireworks has never looked right now.
It looks better than it ever looked.
Yeah. That's how they do fireworks in Taipei.
Yeah.
Left and right started first. Then there came the bridge. And then there came the middle part.
Wow.
So if you would actually see the individual photos, you would have three photos where not too much would go on. But then the combination is what makes it. Now you could argue, well, why not just press the shutter long enough in order to get this all happen? Well, the thing is, in separating the photos, you get much, much more detail into it. Because if you hold it for 8 seconds, even take aside the obvious problem that everything could be blown out, all you see is linear streaks going left and right. Although where you make single shots in shorter time frame in between, you get much more detail into it. So it's not just a lighted line. You actually see sparks. You see much more details. And then, let's say, putting two or three photos together gets the far better end result.
This is gorgeous. So I can even see, which is nice, you've posted this on Google Plus, I could see that some of these are 3-second exposures at f11, and you're doing a pretty low ISO. I guess you don't want any grain in here.
It's the nighttime; you really have to watch out for grain.
Yeah. Yes, and as said, these are actually done with very inexpensive equipment. The camera it's been shot with is a Nikon D90, which is 5 years old, and the lens used is actually the kit lens. So that means, for this kind of photography, obviously better gear helps, but you don't really need it in order to make these kind of shoots happening. So a 5-year-old camera with a kit lens is weight enough in order to get these kind of photos.
If people want to see the full tutorial on Google Plus, you've used the hashtag fireworks tutorial. So you can. I just added Dirk to my circles, my photography circles. Dirk, HENDOERFER, and the hashtag is fireworks tutorial. And you've got a 3-day tutorial online here, which is fantastic. Really appreciated for people who want to get more detail and look at these great shots. Is it the same trick if you have a multiple firework shot that you want to get? Is it the same open the shutter and close the shutter, or do we do something different?
No, it's still the very same. I kind of related to a little bit gut feeling, to be honest. So there's not the set of time. It's like, right. Okay, now 3 2-second one. So even if I take 3 shots, one could be 2 seconds. The one in the middle could be 3 seconds. Uh-huh. And then the end could be 1.5 seconds.
You're fortunate. You have a lot of chance to experiment in Taipei.
Yeah, it's true.
So people should practice. If you're going to do your fireworks shots, if you can go to 2 shows this week.
Yeah, do practice, your first one.
Take practice. It home. Look at it. See what you did. Try different exposures, different ISOs, different f-stops. But if you can't practice, because I'm only going to get 1 shot, just chimp a lot, right? Keep chimping.
Chimping and use a tripod and a cable release.
Cable release, tripod, I got that. And what lens are you using? Are you using a fairly long lens because you're so far away?
Well, this is, and the ones showed you was an 18-104. And the setting was at 50, 48, something like
okay.
that.
Okay, okay. So kind of a medium. Beautiful stuff.
Maybe one tip that a lot of people are missing because it's been set as a feature, but then would kill your night photography. There is a setting in almost every DSLR that says nose reduction on either long exposures or on high ISO. If that is set in your camera and you do the camera, after you're taking the photo, let's say 2 seconds, will take internally another 2-second exposure, completely black, and that will cover the noise of the sensor and reduce it from your actual photo. By definition, it sounds nice, but the reality is when you're shooting fireworks, you want to shoot individual photos very quickly, one after the other, in order to get the ability to build something. So this setting should set it off, because otherwise you're shooting, let's say, for 6 seconds, and then the very next 6 seconds, your camera cannot be operated anymore because he makes this black shoot in order to retract the noise from the sensor. But in these 6 seconds, actually the most gorgeous fireworks could take place.
Yeah.
And given the capabilities nowadays on software, noise reduction either in Lightroom, in Camera Raw, or in Photoshop, these settings are really not needed anymore. So that's just a tip in order to not get frustrated pushing the button and really want to push it right after it and nothing happens.
I want to push everybody to Dirk Heindorfer's Google Plus. This is cool that you've put this on Google Plus, the full tutorial, a 3-day tutorial that covers gear and location scouting, setting up and shooting, and something we didn't get to, but it will be in the post-processing, and you could see some of those images were in Lightroom. So the things that you need to do in Lightroom after the fact in post-processing are also in here. This is just really great. It's about its most complete thing on... Is this how you discovered Dirk? Was this Google Plus post? It's incredible.
Yeah.
Really great. Thank you, Dirk.
Well, thanks, Dirk. Have a great rest of your day. Get some rest.
Yes, sir.
Thanks for staying up late.
You can go to sleep now.
When's your next fireworks display?
In about 2 days.
Oh, good. Dirk is well known for his urban photography, his landscapes, his night photography in Asia. Just gorgeous stuff. If you haven't yet visited him on Google Plus or 500px, just really, really stunning images. And a lot of them are time exposures like this one. Just beautiful. Really great. Great shots of Taiwan. Thank you, Dirk.
Thank you.
It was a pleasure.
Take care. We're going to continue on in just a moment with our guest.
Yeah,
I'm very excited.
Tip,
and you have a tip as well. But
yes,
before we do that, let's mention our friends at Squarespace, the secret behind exceptional websites. If you're a photographer, we should tell Dirk this. I don't think he has a website. He's using Google Plus as his website, but you know, and that's fine. But it's nice to have a home like CatherineHall.net where you can go and that's where your stuff is. And this is where Squarespace just excels. It's hosting plus software, very affordable to make a gorgeous site. And if you're a photographer, you're going to love the photo gallery templates that they offer you. In fact, what I would suggest if you want to look at portfolios is go to squarespace.com and look at the examples link. They have a whole photography section of great photographers. They also have, and I would encourage you to look at this too, the portfolio section of various artists and designers as well, to get an idea of the variety of looks that you can get with squarespace.com. I mean, one of the things I don't like about a lot of content management systems is the sites tend to all look the same, not Squarespace. Yes, sure, you start with templates that are super slick designer templates, but then you customize it, and you don't have to be a CSS or a JavaScript expert. You customize it to make it look the way you want it to look. And that's important, especially if this is your business. But even if it's not, if you just want to show off your stuff, look at this. It's just great to its best advantage. Squarespace.com. Now, here's the deal. If you visit Squarespace.com right now, you just notice there's a green button on there that says try it free. Click that button. You don't need a credit card. All you need is a name for your site, a password, an email address, and you are good to go for 2 weeks. You can use all of the features, including those photo galleries, to design a beautiful site. If you've got an existing site, Squarespace has the most sophisticated import engine out there. Import and, by the way, export. You're never trapped. WordPress, Movable Type, Blogger, and Typepad APIs are supported. That means virtually any site. You can get not only the text, but the images, the tags, the authors, the comments. All the URLs are the same. So you preserve all of the links that you've had. It's a great way to try a site, see if you like it, and if you decide you want to buy Squarespace, you've got to do this. Use our special offer code TWITPHOTO7, and you'll get 10% off your first purchase. I recommend the annual purchases. They have a standard and unlimited plan. As little as $8 a month when you buy annually for the standard plan, $16 a month when you buy annually. You take an additional 10% off that, and when you get an annual plan, as part of the setup, they will register a new domain name for you. So, you know, you could have your name, DirkHeindorfer.com, and it automatically sets it up so it's all of the underlying engineering is done for you automatically. It is really great. Need a new site? Want to try something? Squarespace.com, and if you decide to buy, TWITPHOTO7 is the offer code.
And I have something to throw in on that.
Throw something in.
I have gone through the road of doing custom websites.
As have I.
And I've spent so much money, and I did my first Squarespace site, and it was so easy, and it's beautiful. And I actually tried some other sort of template-based websites and found them to be the most straightforward and honest with their pricing, and you know exactly what you're going to get.
These guys are great.
And I originally had used them for my top model release site, and I moved, and now I'm having buyer's remorse.
Buyer's remorse.
So stick with Squarespace.
I love
it. If I rewound and did it again, that's what I would do.
Plug, top model release. This is Catherine's app for iPhone. If you are doing pictures of people and you need releases, just stop right there. This is all you need. You create the release. They sign it on the site, on the phone. It's emailed home to you and to them. It's approved by Getty Images and by real, actual lawyers. These are real, really good
true
releases.
Lawyers, not lawyer dolls.
Not fake lawyers, not lawyer action figures. So a little plug there for Catherine Hall.
Thank you.
And don't forget Squarespace.com. Offer code TWITPHOTO7. This is a tip. Your tip this week is for me. Get out of your comfy chair.
Yeah, do you notice I like have been doing little tips that are
They're all aimed at me, huh? Oh, now I'm going to go back in time and look.
No, just the last two.
It's really true because you never get a great photo without getting up. I've taken pictures of my feet, of the chair I'm in.
But you could get Aussie from your chair.
I take a lot of. I think that's why you see a lot of food pictures in Aussie and dog pictures and cat pictures because people just go.
Your whole feet
that's
is?
What's here.
Yeah, that's true. It's right there. I don't even have to move.
So sometimes it's worth getting up.
Yes. So my tip is basically get out of your comfy chair, and what I mean by that is. It's really easy to go up to a scene and do what's comfortable and to stay in that comfort zone. So we all have our favorite lenses, our favorite poses, our favorite apertures to use, all these different things, all these choices we have. And as we shoot and shoot, we get into a zone where we have our place that we like to be. And the problem with that is that it really stunts your creativity. And it also keeps you from being inspired and most importantly, having fun.
Here's an example. So you have
here's an example.
This is a before shot.
Yeah, this is me walking up to the scene. And I actually, embarrassingly enough, thought this was a good photograph when I was taking it.
Actually, I thought so too. Should I be embarrassed? I like it.
No, I mean, the angle's not great. The sky is not interesting. It's very flat. And so I started, and this was my initial walk up to the scene, get the photo off. And I was inspired. I was exciting.
We do advise that, though, because sometimes get the shot. You can take as many pictures as you want. Take one now. It won't hurt.
Do the comfy chair shot.
Yeah.
Get that out of the way. But then think about how you can make it better.
Oh, that's so much nicer. You're right. Okay.
And so the things that I did in this particular shot was getting above her so I could have a more interesting background and more depth. Also, it's a more flattering angle on her. And I changed from a 24-millimeter lens to a 150-millimeter lens to give that really nice compression.
And
the lighting
corrected.
From that angle
Look
was
that.
Better as well. Yeah. And of course... Disclaimer, this one's retouched and the other one's not. But as you can see, without even retouching.
You brought up the color and the rocks and stuff. But it's still a... But see, I think if you look at this, I think you look at the rock and go, wouldn't it be cool if that were the background?
Yeah.
Right?
So, anyhow, just challenging yourself and not... It's okay to do that initial shot exactly how you like it, but go ahead and push yourself to try different things and not give up until you have that sort of aha, I know I nailed it. I'm excited about going home and looking at my pictures feeling. So
big difference.
That would be my...
Go to katherinehall.net/blog and you can see the before and after for your very own self. Now let's say hello to Klaus Herrmann.
Yeah, we have a really exciting guest. You know, his background, he's actually a professor for computer science.
Oh.
And in 2008, things shifted. Klaus, enlighten us.
Hi there.
Hi, Klaus. Welcome to Twit Photo. We hear you great.
Welcome to Twit Photo.
Thanks for having me. Thanks. I have to correct you, Catherine. I'm not a professor.
I'm sorry.
In Germany, that's a difference between a researcher and a professor. So not quite a professor. But my background is in teaching and research on university level. And I've done that for 13 years now, and right now I'm transitioning into, let's say, a new career and trying out photography and how this goes.
You know, it's interesting because two of my favorite photographers were also in the computer industry. Chris Marquardt, who is from Tübingen and was originally at HP. And Trey Ratcliffe, who we love.
Yeah, I didn't know he was a computer programmer. It makes sense, though.
Well, Trey Ratcliffe, who is another HDR, great HDR photographer.
You may have heard of him.
Also is a computer programmer. Why do you think that is, Klaus? What is it about technology and photography that go hand in hand?
Well, I think photography can be a very technical thing. And I think that's where many people... actually have problems in managing all the complexities and all the stuff that you need to think about when you take the photo and when you process a photo. It's a lot of software that you need to control. It's a lot of things that you need to find out. And everything is essentially built around technology. So if you have a technology background and you know your way through the computer world and you know how to use these things, I think it's a definite advantage to have that.
And it's not just because it's digital photography either, because I'm Bruce Dale, who we love, National Geographic photographer, film photographer for years, was always a gadget hound.
Oh, he was complete gearhead.
Ansel Adams was a gadget hound. So I think there is some commonality. And yet this is a fine art. In fact, I look at your photos, Klaus. And this is it's the opposite. What's left brain is artistic and right brain is which?
Right brain creative, left brain.
So So you have left brain for computer science, and your right brain is highly developed, clearly, because of these beautiful images.
I think I use the upper half of my brain. I don't know.
The top brain.
The left or right. I don't separate that.
Yeah.
No,
yeah.
Well, I just use it.
It's good to know, because I think sometimes people say, oh, you're so left-brained, you couldn't possibly be a great photographer or painter or musician or
artist. Well, I think a lot of times, like, engineers and people that are doing those technical fields, they often do have a really creative side. And do you feel when you're doing the more computer science-oriented work, were you able to be creative? And how has it served you?
I mean, there's a lot of creativity in all of these, or in both of these fields. Of course, if you do computer science, you have to be very creative in finding solutions to problems. Mm. And you also have to be very good in explaining it to people, because that's really the side that makes a good researcher. Not only if you can find a good technical solution, but if you can explain it in simple terms to people. So creativity is involved there heavily. It may be a different type of creativity than you need for photography. But, you know, maybe when I started doing photography, I think a hidden side of my creativity kind of woke up, and I found it quite easy to do this. Photography is something that comes natural to me, I think. And it may be that this comes down to being a creative person, probably.
Yeah. It's funny. I like you, I was drawn to photography because it complemented what I'm very auditory, was in radio for years, and I wanted to develop my visual side. And so photography was attractive to me for that reason. I think, you know, computer science can be very abstract and very internalized. This brings that creativity external. So it's a nice complement for what you do from 9 to 5, I think. You, I see a lot of HDR in your work. Is this your favorite medium to use?
HDR is, I started out, surfing the web and looking at stuff that people did, and this kind of caught my eye. This is actually not an HDR.
No, it's beautiful macro photography.
Yeah. So I think I got fascinated by the colorful and detail-rich photography that I was seeing, and I started researching, you know, because that's my second nature. I started researching into the topic, and I found that it was really fun to do this. And I think right now HDR is kind of a tool for me to get all the details and to get the basis for what I'm doing with these images, because really HDR is like 10% of what I do with these images, and then the rest of the 90% is like going wild in Photoshop and editing these things. So HDR is like the basic technology that I use to get everything out of the images that I'm processing.
So you've always been a big proponent of practicing HDR. Why do you think it's important?
To practice HDR?
Yes.
I don't know whether it's important. I mean, HDR is kind of a very controversial thing, right? I mean, if you look into what Trey Radcliffe, for example, publishes, or what I publish, I think there's one negative comment for every 10 positive comments, at least. So it's quite controversial. So I don't know whether you have to practice it or whether you have to do it. But to me, it's kind of it's a tool. It's a tool. I see a scene, for example, a beautiful night scene like this, and I just take a series of brackets. I take an exposure bracketing series, and I see what I can get out of it. So there's not a lot of philosophy behind the idea of HDR here. As I said, it's kind of the first step of a very long process that I do. And since it's just a fundamental tool, I think everybody should be able to use it. So just practice it. Just try to do some exposure series and try out how it works. And maybe go to my website and read some tutorials.
You have a great tutorial on the making of the St. John's Cathedral in Valletta. This is in Malta.
Yeah.
at Farbspiel Photography. That's the website. Farbspiel, Farbspiel-photo.com.
That's the German part of that.
Farbspiel. You know. What does that stand for? What does that mean?
Farbe is color and Spiel is playing. So I'm playing with color.
I love it. And this is a video that you can watch. I love that. That's a good word. I'm going to use Farbspiel from now on. I will Farbspiel you.
So this is a making of video that I've been doing for a while now. This is actually, I think, the very first one that I did. And
we're looking at a minute and a half time lapse, so you're seeing it's moving very quickly.
Yes, that is kind of the shortest making of video that you'll find on my website. It's very brief. So it's 90 seconds of the process of doing this, and of course it's crazy fast. So don't try to follow everything that you see, but it just gives you an impression of the process and the work that goes into one of these images.
I like this because it's nice. You know, sometimes you get buried in the step by step, and so it's nice to see kind of an overview of the picture, and of course as it evolves. But maybe we should go step by step through some of the process.
Well, panoramas are so important, and you're going into these majestic churches, and the typical thing would be to do a panoramic shot. What's inspiring you to do the vertorama, and where did that come from?
You call it a vertorama because you're pointing up.
Yeah. Vertical. Right. Panorama would be.
So maybe the first question, what got me to do this? Really an accident. So I'm certainly not the inventor of vertorama photography, but maybe I'm the one using it extensively for interiors. Maybe the first one, I don't know really. But what got me to do it is really an accident, or maybe not an accident, but I took some shots. I was in Paris in the Galerie Lafayette, I think it's called, in the big shopping mall.
Yes.
And I was shooting just for fun, and when we got back home, I got to my computer, I looked at the images, and I found that I've accidentally shot two photos that would perfectly fit together if you stitch them in vertical direction. So I did that, and it worked out really well. So it was an interesting effect to see how this interior kind of opens towards you, because that's the effect that you get. Essentially do is I'm shooting very much in the same way as you shoot a panorama. So most people probably know what a panorama is. You shoot several images in horizontal direction, and then you stitch them together to have a much wider angle of view. And you can very simply just turn that 90 degrees and do that in vertical direction. So you start at the very bottom. Essentially, the first image that you take when you're in a church is an image of your feet. And the very last image is an image of the ceiling that is right behind your head. And you then get a series of these images. And for every one of them, you can produce a bracketing series. So you get, for example, three shots for every section of this vertorama scene. And then you essentially combine them into HDRs, and then you stitch them into a vertorama. So that's like the basic rundown in a nutshell. What you see here is actually the small image that you see in this description is a before and after. So if you go to that, you see the source images.
That's really great that you share this with people. I love it that you're not hiding. Somebody in our chat room says sometimes photographers treat their secret recipes like barbecue sauce. They won't tell anybody how it's made.
But not me. Sharing is my second nature.
Yeah, that's wonderful. You're very open.
Education is my third nature, so I really enjoy doing that. What you see here is really a very quick presentation of the three major stages that you have for such an image. On the left side, you have the source photos. So these are the photos that I actually took in this church.
In this case, four photos starting with the floor moving up to the top of the church, and you're bracketing each of those four three times. And is it how many stops? Two stops apart?
These are two stops apart. Yeah, I shot those handheld. So and I don't have like the most high-end professional cameras. So I'm still on a crop camera with three auto bracketing steps. So I use that, and plus two, minus two, and zero exposure values. And then you have the source images, and then later when you come home to the to your computer, you, you first of all, I merge these. So every set that you see here, every section, is then merged to an individual HDR image. And then I go to Photoshop and stitch these images together. And what you see in the middle is what you get out of this process. So you've seen in the video, you've seen that the shape is kind of strange. It has like rugged edges and this stuff. And it's you have to straighten it. And then you have to crop it, and then I start post-processing it.
So you use for your stitching software. You use Photoshop.
Yeah.
And then you have to do you have to square it. You have to crop it, but you also fix the distortion. And you do see that in the video. You're fixing the distortion in Photoshop, so that it looks kind of straight lines instead of looming over you or twisted around.
Which function do you use in Photoshop to fix the distortion?
First of all, why do I use Photoshop for the stitching? I mean, there's tools out there that are, let's say, much more sophisticated and have much more control over the process.
Yes, why?
So I'm asking the questions myself. The reason why I do that is very simple. I'm lazy. And Photoshop is very good at doing this. And you don't really need a lot to do there. You just give it your images. That was like the split second where you saw the tool, the photo merge tool.
Yeah.
So you and it just does a wonderful job of doing this without you having to do too much parameter tweaking and this kind of stuff. So it really it's a very straightforward and simple tool to do that.
And you use the auto layout.
I use the let me see. If you see this, the photo merge
dialogue here.
I use this the cylindrical.
Cylindrical. Okay. All right. That's
thing,
good
because
enough.
That's what it really is. It's like a picture being wound around some bottle or some can.
Right.
And then for the what you get out of this is, as I said, a very coarse result. So the edges are not very good. And if you let it run, you'll see that.
Yeah.
It actually takes a while. Yeah, there you see, it doesn't really look very good. So what you do then is I use the distort tools. So you have transformation tools. That's what I'm doing right here.
You're actually stretching it up in one corner and pulling it down.
The reason I'm doing that is that a Vertorama shot, many people mistake it for a fisheye shot, and
right.
The difference between this type of Vertorama shot and a fisheye shot is that in a fisheye shot, virtually every line you have in the image is bent, you know, except for those lines that go straight through the center of your image.
If you look at it before you've transformed it, it really does look kind of whopper jawed.
It looks a bit goofy, yeah.
That's an American word. It's like Farbspiel, whopper jawed.
Yeah. I've never heard that word. That's a Leo word.
Oh, you didn't. You didn't too, Catherine. Yes. So I'm not alone here.
No, it's me.
So you really need to straighten those lines because all the horizontal lines in these images are still horizontal. So it's not. That's the difference to a fisheye shot. It's the different kind of distortion. And then I'm just dragging those edges of the image to make those lines straight. You know, all the there's a lot of lines in those images, and you can really, if you have a grid, and I've enabled the grid here, you can really drag the corners to make this straight again. And that's what you need to do because otherwise it wouldn't really look good.
And then the crop, of course, to get the
crease. Another very important thing in this type of photography is the symmetry. So I'm very careful when I'm entering a church like this, for example, to be straight on the center line on the aisle of the church, and dead center beneath the dome, for example, because if you go like one step to the left or one step to the right, it's ruined. It just you can never straighten it up. It just looks, what was the word?
Whopper jawed.
Whopper job. And you cannot really fix it in Photoshop. Taking the shots symmetrical is very important. And I'm also using I'm using a very wide angle lens. So this is a 10 millimeter lens, or 15 millimeters if you if it's on a full frame camera. So you really have to be careful with the distortion, and you have to take care that you are very precise in taking the original photos.
15, 1.5, not 5.0, so it's a pretty wide.
Yeah. 15, yes. Yeah. It's a 10 to 24 Nikon I'm using. Mm-hmm. I use it on a crop camera, so if you the equivalent would be 15 millimeters on a full frame.
So you've stitched it, you've transformed it, you've cropped it, and now you've imported it into Photomatix. That's the HDR tool you like to use.
Right. In this process, I'm actually using Photomatix two times. I used it for merging the original exposures into 32-bit HDR images. These are the kind of images that you can never use or view. This is exactly the place where I did this. Mm-hmm. I did the stitching of the 32-bit images in Photoshop. And that's other tools can do that too, but if you try that in other tools, you may get problems with the 32 bits. So not every image editing tool can do this.
Another reason to use Photoshop. So you're doing 32-bit TIFFs. That's what Photomatix is output.
No, it's not. No? It's not TIFFs. It's the format is called EXR, I think. Uh-huh. So it's a special HDR.
But Photoshop can handle it. Okay.
Photoshop can handle it. So I'm producing the HDRs, the 32-bit HDRs, and then doing the stitching in Photoshop, and then going back to Photomatix because I still need to tone map the Vatorama shot. So I'm using Photomatix two times in this very workflow here that you see. But you can actually get away with using it only one time, which is a few years ago, Photomatix had this this habit of if I would have tone mapped those images separately, they would have had different colors and different tonalities, and the stitching wouldn't have been very good. But in the meantime, they've really improved it, and now you can use Photomatix at the start of the process to produce the tone-mapped HDR images, and then go to Photoshop and stitch those, and then stay in Photoshop for the rest of the processing.
So when you're lining these up, I mean, I understand how having it straight must be so important. When you're using a wide-angle lens, everything is distorted. How are you ensuring that it's straight?
I'm just
trying.
Using
any tools, or is it just trial and error? Because sometimes tips are.
It is a combination of different things. Most of these images are shot handheld, so that makes it a bit more difficult. If you can afford to have a tripod, if they allow you to have a tripod, which in most churches and other places you cannot. It's really important to have the right tools. And I've been fortunate enough to watch your pre-show preparation, and Leo complained that one of my gear images was not identifiable, so you didn't know what it was.
It was a mystery.
It was a mystery, right. But that's one important tool that you really need to... To get these Vatorama shots perfectly. If you can use a tripod. If you can't, you have to shoot handheld, of course.
So this is what you were talking about, and I still don't know what the hell it is.
So what could it be, Leo? Take a guess.
Well, it's obviously a head. I mean, that would go on a tripod.
It's a track.
And it looks like it's a track that we would slide along with it.
Yes.
Mm. Very lots well. Of levels. Yes.
What this is actually a panorama head. It's a very simple panorama tripod head that actually I've built myself from parts that I've bought on the internet.
Well, no wonder I didn't know what it was. It's a Frankenstein.
You're an intelligent man and you have some imagination, so I thought...
I kind of knew. I've seen panorama heads before. Really Right Stuff sells them and others, but this is interesting. So you've combined a variety of different things. Yes, now this is funny because this is a panorama head that's a horizontal panorama, and you shoot vertical panoramas. So how do you use this? You put it on its side.
So Leo, how would I use that to shoot vertical?
Look at that
panorama?
Clip
again with Klaus's Socratic method.
There's the clip. The clip has something to do with this.
Yes, you can. What you see on the left side is the L bracket where the camera actually
camera
goes.
Camera sits there, yeah. Right, and it would normally it would slide. So I guess I'm just trying to think how you can, because what you really want to do is have the camera rotate along its horizontal axis, so, not its vertical axis.
What you see here is really the minimum that you need. Let me explain it step by step.
Yes, please.
On the right lower corner, you see this thing that has the lowest spirit level. So, that's the panorama plate. So that's actually a thing that you screw to your tripod head.
And that actually rotates, yes?
Yes. You see the blue rim down there, the blue rim with the numbers?
Yeah.
That's actually the thing that rotates. So the whole thing can be rotated around this, right, yeah.
We've got degrees on it, so that makes
it, yes. Yeah. Right. So you can really fine-tune the angle to which you you rotate your camera between the shots. And on top of that is really a quick-release clamp and a macro rail. So this was never designed to be something that was used in a panorama shoot, but it's a simple macro rail that people use in macro photography to place their camera with respect or relative to the subject. And I'm using it to find the no parallax point of my camera.
Now I understand.
Because that's very important. If you can use a tripod, then you should do it right and rotate your camera straight around the point where you don't produce any parallax errors.
Some cameras will have this marking on the lens or the body of the camera, which is the pivot point. It's a circle usually with a cross in it that you're supposed to rotate around. Is that what you're talking about?
I don't know. I think you're talking about the mark on the camera.
Well, it depends on the camera itself. Sometimes it's on the lens, because it depends where the never mind.
Well, maybe you could.
I thought you wanted to rotate around the film plane. Do you not?
People might know what parallax means. If you could explain that.
Yeah. The problem is that if you turn the camera just in some arbitrary way, you're going to produce parallax errors. So if you have you take two images of an object that is close to the camera and an object that is further away from the camera, you're going to produce an offset between these two objects in the images. So you turn the camera and it's like, that's like a website that explains it.
Yeah. Yep.
So you have to turn your camera around this very well chosen point in order to make the images that the overlap between the images really match, so that the stitching software is able to stitch them together. If you don't do that, the stitching software will find that the tree on one image is left to the house and on the other it's right to the house.
That's not good.
It can't do anything with it, right? Yeah. So the macro rail and the L bracket that you saw in the mysterious image are really there for
finding
that point, right? For sliding the camera and the lens on that rail and on the L bracket on the quick release clamp on the left side, to really find that point around which you have to rotate the camera to avoid these parallax errors. And that's really trial and error. So you're sitting in your garden and with a stick close to your camera and a stick a bit further away, and then you just try to slide it back and forth until you find that point. And then you make a mark, and you also see that mark on the image there where I scratched it into the adapter. And that's a very essential tool.
Photoden has given me the word that I'm looking for. It was the nodal point of the camera. Are these ever marked? Aren't these? I thought that's what the film plane mark was, but I guess it's not.
No. The film plane mark just tells you where your sensor is.
Oh,
But that's not the nodal point. The nodal point is somewhere towards the front of the lens. It's not necessarily the front of the lens, but it's somewhere at the front of the lens.
Big Ben's really Panorama Tutorials has an image here that will help you maybe understand. Help me, because I'm a knucklehead, understand what we're trying to accomplish here. So you just have to figure it out by trial and error, huh?
Oh yes. Don't do it while you're in the church, because it won't work. Now you have to find that out before you go out, and it's just a setup thing, and then you fix it to that position. Probably you're going to use the same ultra wide angle lens for your shots all the time, and then it's really a one time setup, and you're done. You're
do you put a? Did you take a little nail polish or put a dot on your lens where that?
Oh yes.
So you know from now on.
Not on the lens?
On the body.
Not on the lens, but on the panorama.
On the head?
So, on the
head
itself.
Yeah, I actually scratched it in with a nail or something.
There's a scratch. Is that it right there?
Exactly. That's the mark.
The mark of the nodal point.
If I didn't have that, I would be lost.
So that's what we're going to pivot around?
Yeah.
Got it.
Exactly.
And that point changes based on what lens you have on it, or does it stay consistent?
It does. Yes. In fact, if it's a zoom, you got to mark where on the zoom. Yeah.
If you screw on a different lens, chances are that you will not even be able to use this type of adapter, because you may end up with a nodal point that is far further away for this. Because this is a very compact adapter that really fits my needs with a 10 to 24 lens. And that's perfect.
And this is as long as we're talking gear, this is the lens you use.
Oh, yes. To do this type of photography, you really need a very wide-angle lens. Because if you ever went into a church with like a 50 or a 70 millimeter lens, you will have found out that it's not a good lens for getting the entire church into the frame. So you really need this wide-angle this type of wide-angle lens. Otherwise, you will need to take multiple rows for your Vertorama, which gets quite complex, and you cannot really do it handheld. Or it's very much more complex if you do it handheld.
Time-consuming.
Yes. So essentially, you would have to pan up and down multiple times for the same scene, and then take. From bottom to top and left to right, multiple rows to achieve the same thing. So a super wide-angle lens is very important for this type of photography.
Now, if that weren't complicated enough, look, here's a Vertorama with people in it. How do you do that?
Yes, I asked them to stay where they are.
Because if they move, it won't work.
And you can imagine how complicated that gets when you're in a Muslim country.
Oh, this is a mosque, not a church, of course.
Yeah. Oh, yes. It's a mosque in Istanbul.
Yeah. And what did you just shout? Don't move.
I shouted it in Turkish. No, just kidding.
You know, it makes it a great shot, though, because it's almost like a painting where there's lots of little things going on in corners here. And it really becomes a fascinating shot as a result.
Yeah, that is actually a good point. I mean, when you're dealing with so many people, how are you asking them not to move?
I don't. A very simple fact, I don't. I never bother to go around and ask all the 100 people, or maybe 7 in this shot, to not move, because that's never going to work. I'm just shooting. I have confidence in my abilities to fix this in post-processing.
So you're using Photoshop to pick one image of them, I guess. And eliminate the rest.
It depends. Yeah. I mean, when I merge this bottom section of this Vertorama, I can, for example, use the deghosting function in Photomatics.
Right.
So Photomatics has a function for doing this for you. Sometimes it works. Sometimes it doesn't work so well. But that's one possibility. And the other one is always to have your clone stamp and your healing brush and all this kind of stuff. Because it's really little things. I mean, you're taking these three shots in like much less than a second. And the little kind of movement that you have there on the bottom, you can really fix that in Photoshop with the clone brush, for example.
So was this handheld?
Yes.
Amazing.
And do you
they wouldn't allow me a tripod.
And that's true. Most churches and mosques is, and temples, they don't like tripods in there.
It depends a bit on the country that you're in. In most countries, somebody will come up to you and very politely ask you not to use a tripod. Or he'll ask you whether you're a professional photographer. And I always respect this. I don't, because if you don't, it's like a hide-and-seek game and you're... Right. You're in a hurry, and it really doesn't pay off. And one tip that I can give anybody who's trying to do HDR in this type of situation is learn how to handhold your shots, because that will open you will open opportunities that you will never have if you are depending on a tripod. For example, here in the this is St. Peter's Cathedral in Rome, or in the Vatican, to be more precise. They just wouldn't allow you. So if you can't shoot handheld, you don't have a shot. So I can, if there would be one major tip that I could give people in terms of HDR, if you're interested in it, practice doing HDR handhelds. Go to churches, go to places where you have low light, and just practice it. With the practice, you will develop your abilities to do this. And this will open up new opportunities for you to shoot inside churches, for example.
Do you ever use a monopod or just a tripod or handheld?
I'm using a monopod too. It depends on the situation. I mean, sometimes I forget it in the hotel room, or I'm too lazy to get it out. You know, it's like, I wish I would do everything perfect every time, but sometimes it's just like, okay, now I'm here. Sometimes I have like 5 minutes to take a shot or something, and then it's just handheld. And the better you are at handholding your shots, the more shots you will get eventually. But I do use a monopod, and but I've been thrown out of churches with a monopod too. So right. In Italy, I've went into a church one time with a monopod, and I thought I'm very clever, and I'm going to trick them into thinking that it's not some kind of a camera support, but a lady stepped up to me and said, no tripods. And I was thinking, okay, I'm still clever. And I said, it's not a tripod, it's a monopod. And she said, okay, no stands. So it's like, maybe sometimes you could use it, most of the time you can't. What the advantage that you have with a monopod could be that it adds a little bit of weight to your system. So sometimes I have a monopod on my camera, but I just don't extend it. And it gives me, like, you know, these film cameras where you have weights that stabilize it so that it won't move and it won't vibrate. And kind of a monopod, even if you don't extend it, kind of has a similar effect.
It's like a steady cam.
Yeah, right. Steady cam. That's the word that I was looking for. So this can help you, but as I said, sometimes I'm just too lazy, or it's too little time, or I forgot it in the hotel room. You know, it's life. So if you can take it handheld, if you're able to do it, great. You're going to come out with a shot. If not, maybe you're going to have to come back.
So coming from a lazy person that hates to carry a tripod, what are any tips on keeping yourself
stable? I left mine in Norway.
Did you? Yeah. Oh, yeah, but you did it on purpose.
No, but it doesn't matter.
You left your tripod on purpose in Norway?
No, I left my monopod. I would have gone back to get my tripod. It's a Gitzo. I couldn't afford to leave that. But I left my Manfrotto
That's actually
monopod.
A tip from Leo. If you're traveling,
don't lose your Gitzo.
Take a monopod that you can leave behind.
Yeah, you know, that's actually Mikkel Olin's tip. He says, I just go buy a cheap tripod wherever I am and leave it. Because who wants to carry that around? I want to ask about macro photography, too, because you have one image in here that we showed it before. It's just a beautiful...
Yeah, but real quick.
Yeah, go ahead.
Any tips on stabilizing your camera when you're shooting handheld?
Yeah, how do you do this handheld? I don't even understand how you could do this handheld.
Yes, it's a magic trick that I apply. I can't tell you right now, but okay, just kidding. It's not that complicated. Many people, if you read tutorials on the web on shooting handheld and shooting in low light handheld, many people say that you have to squeeze tight and push your elbow into your hip and hold your breath, and I don't do all this stuff. To me, the secret to getting good handheld shots in low light is being relaxed. You know, don't cramp. Don't just get a good stand, a stable stand. Relax. Don't flex any muscles that you don't have to. Take a breath. Exhale halfway. Hold your breath for a split second and then take the shot.
And do you do the, because you want to do three shots, right? Three bracketed shots. Do you take them just lickety split, boom, 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 and then pan up, and then boom, 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 and then pan up?
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. Right. Yeah. So the image that you just showed is actually not a Vertorama. It's a single shot made out of six handheld shots, and for that I actually switch between the user settings on my camera between the first three and the second three shots. So there are a few tips and tricks that you can use to get the right number of shots, even if you don't have the most expensive camera.
You shot all of this with the D90.
This was shot with the D7000, I think, and some of the shots were made with the D90. Yeah.
Wow.
So it's not really a very expensive gear.
So when you're tone mapping these images, you know, as far as keeping within the extremes, can you explain how you find that sort of nice balance?
And I think when people complain about Trey's HDRs and others and yours, it's that sometimes the tone mapping is so extreme it looks like a painting. And this is a good example.
See, did you like how he said that? He says, "Yeah, what's the problem?"
So what?
It's my prerogative.
That's my question. So what?
Well,
I mean, I liked it. It's a question of personal preference, actually.
It is, absolutely.
Of course, if you go to the internet and you surf through Flickr and other platforms, you will see a lot of very awful HDR images that are really overdone. You could argue that some of mine are also overdone. It's just a matter of taste, but I just like that. I like the kind of painterly effect that you have on some of these images.
A lot of your stuff is very. This is all very subtle, and beautiful, by the way.
But how do you find that balance of when do you know it's overdone?
I know when I get the first 10 negative comments on my head. That's when I really know. No, it's actually, and I wrote that in one of the tips that I sent you, and I think we're just going through them right now without looking at them.
Kind of informally,
but. One of my rules is moderation is key. Don't go to extremes.
Yeah.
So if you're using Photomatics or any other HDR software for that matter, you can easily go to extremes. And there are presets that you can click on that will send you to this extreme straight away without touching any slider. So what I do is actually I start from a default setting that is very natural, that actually excuse me, that actually doesn't do a whole lot to the image, and then from there on I'm developing it using the sliders one after the other. So one tip would be not to jump wildly from one preset to the other and try to figure out which one you use. I don't use presets at all. I'm just going step by step. Just go from the most important sliders. In Photomatics, you will have the strength slider at the very top. And then it's like the first section of parameters is the most important one. And try to get it right in that section such that you don't overdo it. I mean, we could go into the details, but I think that's not what we're trying to do here. But really, using the usually called grunge presets and this type of name, just stay away from these and try to develop your image step by step using the sliders. And then it's just like your natural ability to tell when it's good, and that's your personal style. I mean, if somebody is really into extreme HDRs, go for it. If that's your style, do it. It's I wouldn't call mine extreme. I wouldn't call Trey Ratcliffe's images extreme. It's just a personal style thing. And then, obviously...
I want to point out one thing that you do. When
the copyright?
This is just so clever. You sneak a copyright into most of your images, and you do it so gently and subtly.
It was actually there when I photographed it.
Oh.
I asked the guys on the Berlin-Brandenburg gate to...
You don't remember seeing that when I was in Berlin last time.
I phoned them. It took them 2 weeks to install it, and there it was.
It's a very clever way of doing this. And I don't know if it's in all the images, but I was looking.
No, it's not. It's not really in all of them.
I was looking for it in the images too.
Well, I would go to.
I kind of want to see it in all of them.
Yeah, I was looking at it. Okay, here's another example.
Yeah,
I was looking at a church image, and I was looking at it on the floor, and I was thinking, what religion is that? Because I don't recognize. This
symbols.
Is an example.
Oh, yeah.
Is this Greek Orthodox? What is this? And then I go, it's a copyright.
So actually,
so
that is a good copyright.
I love it.
It's coincidence. I've just a couple of days ago I've published a tutorial on that. So if you're interested, or if any of the viewers are interested,
if you go to my website,
you'll find a link straight on the first site.
It's better than a watermark.
Yeah, definitely better than a watermark, and easier to.
And
people won't.
It's like there are these lengthy discussions about whether you do watermark or you don't watermark, and it's like it's almost like a religion. I do watermark, and you see how I do it. I'm just having a bit of fun of doing this and integrating the watermarks into the images just to make them appear as if they have been there. It's like a little fun thing, and the viewers enjoy it, and some of the viewers email me or comment and say, oh, I found it on your last image.
I think, Klaus, you have to start doing it in every image.
No, yeah, that's, you started a trend. There's expectations.
It's so subtle in some cases.
Yeah. You made a joke about how do you know you've gone too much and people commenting. And you're very active on Google+ in the community. How do you, and you've also talked about style and staying consistent to your style. So how do you do that balance where you are, in a sense, sharing to, in a way, satisfy your viewers, but then also staying true to who you are?
Good question. And one of the tips that I wrote down was to stay true to yourself, because it's like everywhere else in life, it's the same. If you start pretending, if you start doing things because other people want you to do it, or because you think they like what you're doing, and you do it just because you think that, you're not going to get very far. People will recognize it eventually. So to stay authentic, I would just, do your thing and find your style. Don't try to imitate anybody to a great extent. Of course, we all look at people who we admire, and we try to figure out how they do it, and then we try to imitate that at first. But try to find your style and then stick with it. And if you're a person that does well with other people, is a social person, then you're going to be fine. People are going to respect you for what you do, and they find that you're authentic, and that's the most important thing. So I do listen, or I do read all my comments. They're important for me to see what people say, what people think, but I don't take every one of them to my heart, because some of them are really like aggressive or offensive stuff. And I don't change my style because anybody thinks that my images are rubbish.
Good.
Yeah, and that's, Leo, something that you excel at.
You know, I wanted to ask about Topaz, because we've talked about the fact that you use Photomatics and that you use Adobe Photoshop. But I notice you use a Topaz plugin on a lot of these. This is Topaz Adjust you're using here. Tell me how you use that.
Well, I go to the filter menu, and then I find the Topaz Labs. No.
That much I know. But what are you using Topaz for?
I'm using the current Topaz Adjust 5, I think it is. I'm actually using a lot of their plugins, and I don't get paid by them to say that, but I think it's just a tremendous value for your money, and they're doing quite nice
software. I love
software.
Them. Yeah, I purchased them. I love them.
So what I mean, this goes down to the philosophy that I've told you before for Photomatics. Don't go to the extremes, you know,
right.
Because that's the same type of software. You have a bunch of presets on the left side that you can choose, and you're probably not going to hell if you use them, but you're close to it.
You ought to.
So actually, I have a tutorial on my website about using Topaz Adjust, and what I do, I really only touch like three or four sliders, and I do incremental little changes, and I see how they play out. I go back and forth. I look at the before and after, which you can do easily in Topaz Adjust. And then I just go for it. I don't go to extremes there because it's just, again, a tiny step on the whole journey. And if you're looking at a making of right now, and there you, that's a 10-minute making of, and there you get a good idea of what that journey is, and that really... It's not like Topaz Adjust or Photomatics. It's just the combination
right.
of all the things that you do to the photo.
Well, it's
so
fun
don't
to see
go
this.
To extremes for it's, one of these tools.
It's fun to see this because I loved this image, and it's really fun to see the original and to see how. And there's quite a bit of work that actually you went into this image, and you just really did this gorgeous job. You must you like fiddling with stuff, I guess, huh?
Oh, yes. I'm a tech guy, remember?
And you do a lot of drawing. Are you using a Wacom to do all the drawing? Or?
Yes, I do. If for this kind of work, if you want to do that, you really need a graphics tablet to do it, because it's drawing with your mouse, painting a mask with your mouse is really cumbersome, and you don't want to do it. It's not much fun. You can get... a tablet, for example, by Wacom for a little money, I think as much as...
Yeah, the bamboos.
$100 or something like that. Mm-hmm. And it really helps you.
Oh, gosh. I can't imagine using a mouse.
So for those listening, he's using a mask tool to things like mask the windows and then change the windows individually, the lighting through the windows and so forth.
Right.
And that's
that's
a finicky... thing, but I think with a tablet would be a lot easier. And I'm so glad you make these stop motions. These are really a useful way to get an overview of what's
People
going on.
People complain that they're too fast.
No, I like it.
No, that's the point.
I like it. I wouldn't want to watch this in real time.
Yeah, you wouldn't, because it's like this is like
be rather boring.
Trying to remember how long this took, it could easily have been like 3 to 4 hours altogether.
Down to
obviously,
10 minutes.
I stopped in the middle and took a coffee break or something. So you don't see every single bit of trial and error here, because that would be a bit boring. But it's really like, let's say, 4 hours squeezed into 10 minutes. And
it's really useful.
I think it gives you an impression of what you could do to an image,
mm-hmm.
And which tools you could use. And they're HD, so you could... In YouTube, you could really watch it full screen in high definition and then stop at any point and just look at the numbers and the parameters I dial in. So that's kind of the educational side of it.
It's a good point. I mean, in fact, we did that a little bit. You don't have to watch it at full speed. You can pause it and go through some parts slowly and so forth. It's just really fun to watch you work. I've always liked these kinds of stop motion on artists and watching them work. It really is a great way of getting the feel for what you're doing.
My inspiration for that is actually from digital painters. So I've been seeing a couple of digital painters on Flickr, for example, mm-hmm. who were creating tremendous artwork from parts of photos and then painting in Photoshop. And some of them actually present their work as this type of time-lapse movie. And I was always fascinated by it. So one day I thought, why not? I mean, I'm doing so many things to these photos, so maybe it would be enjoyable to present it in this way. And I think people like it.
This is a good example. I didn't realize you'd done this. You made the floor somewhat red in this church around the baptismal font.
Yes.
And now to make
it... That's where many people scream fake.
Because to make it more realistic, you're distressing it a little bit. You're adding some... some dirt and grime. Yeah. And yeah, right. People would say, well, that's now it's a painting. It's not a photograph.
And I'm happy with that. If people would like to call me a digital artist, I would go with that. No problem.
I agree completely. Well, this picture grabbed me. I loved it.
So I'm a guy that doesn't need a box to fit in. So right. If anybody comes up with a good name for it, I'll take it.
Well, you're an artist, that's for sure. These are beautiful. We're talking to Klaus Hermann. His website where you can see these videos is Farbspiel, FarbSpiel-photo.com. You can also buy prints.
Yeah, and he's coming out with an ebook actually soon on Nirvertoramas, correct?
Oh, yeah, right. So I've been writing on an ebook on the Vertorama technique for some time now, and the manuscript is almost finished, so it should be out in I don't have an exact launch date right now, but it should be out in the coming weeks. So if you're interested in reading every little detail of how you can produce your own Vertorama shots from handheld shooting, tripod shooting, and the post-processing side of it, step-by-step instructions, just go to my website, subscribe, and I will notify you once it's out. And maybe you will also get a little discount.
That's so cool. I'm watching him put the copyright in here.
You're so meticulous.
It's really great.
Yeah.
Really, really cool. So tell us about macro photography. It looks like you don't do a lot of it.
No, I've actually... it's kind of, I was about to say I'm bored with what I do, but I'm not, obviously. But there comes a time when you have a feeling that what you're pretty good at what you're doing, and you need to take a step into some other direction. And so I've always been fascinated, but that was not my image.
No, then. No, that's my desktop. I'm just going to pull
it
up.
It would have worked.
Turned out to be a macro.
I've always been fascinated with great macro shots, so I've... bought some gear for it, and just finding my way through the trial and error parts of macro photography. What you see here is actually a macro taken entirely on my desk at home. So this is not out in the nature, but
I love the droplets. Loved. Using a what? A flashlight?
I'm using three flashlights for this macro, so there's really nothing natural about this image. But sometimes that's what it takes to get a good shot.
Titus in our chat room says, "How did you glue the water to the flower petals?"
Oh, I convinced the flower that it would glue to the leaf. Now it's simple. I was actually. When I was planning that shot, I set up the flower, I looked at it, and I thought, it's a flower. But there was something missing, and yeah. I thought, well, some droplets would be nice.
Beautiful. Yeah.
And I went searching through our apartment, trying to find something with which I could apply droplets. And then my wife asked, "What are you looking for?" Nothing, honey. I just rushing through
what
the apartment.
What are you up to, Klaus? What are you up to?
Yeah, and so she asked me, what are you looking for? And I said, something to apply a droplet to a flower. And she just said, why don't you tell me, honey? And she came up with this syringe with a very, very fine needle, and that was perfect for it. So I was applying the droplets are actually so small that they stick to the leaf.
Wow.
Okay, so you're not working with motion.
So I had enough time to position the flashlights and then take the shot.
So how did you position? I see there's a backlight, a side light, and where was the third one?
Yep. Yeah, there's one, let me see, I think there was one to the bottom right, a bit shifted to the front, so lit from the front, one to the upper left, slightly behind the flower, and the third one was lighting the cardboard, the blue cardboard in the background.
Neat.
Yeah, the blue, it's great having that complementary color in the background.
Yeah.
Make it pop.
So many gorgeous images. Do we cover all three tips? Would that even, organically, would that even...
There was a lot more than three, but I think...
We covered at least three tips,
yeah.
But I actually sent you nine.
3x3, you said.
Yes. All right, your photography life.
Yeah, well, we'll run through them. How about that?
Yeah.
So I've got them right here on my screen.
Go ahead.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, tip one, practice shooting handheld. We did that.
We did that, yeah. So it will really open up things for you. We did that also.
Don't go to hell.
So don't, don't go to extremes with right? your tone mapping.
That was like implicitly in what we what we discussed. Many people think that they're using Photomatics, they're fiddling with the sliders, they're saving their image and then upload it to Google+. But what I do is actually, and you saw that in the videos, obviously, is like 90% at least of the work is done after the image comes out of Photomatics. So it's really the post-processing that's done in Photoshop after you tone mapped the original image that makes the image. Photomatics itself is just a tool that starts the whole journey.
Yep.
So it applies to any kind of photography actually. Learn how to use Photoshop or any other image editing tool and learn what it can do for your images, and you will be surprised what you can get out of it.
You've also got three tips about online sharing. You've done so well on Google+. In fact, I noticed I have you in two circles.
Oh, not there
just,
you go.
Not
really?
Just one.
Oh, that's, yeah. Oh, that's you.
That's me.
Sharing okay. photos. The 5,000 shots you brought home from the Eiffel Tower. Share only one, not all 5,000. Thank you.
But I took 5,000.
Yeah, I know, Leo. But you see, I don't want to watch all of them.
No.
Unless you do Petra style.
The problem is, and I've been through this 100 times. You've been to a beautiful place, and you took like maybe it's not even five, but it's maybe 7,000 or maybe even 1,000 shots. And people tend to like do this mass sharing thing where you see an image of a scene, and then like 2 hours later you see the second image of the scene, not very much different, and then you see a third image of the scene. I mean, if you, it all depends on what you're trying to achieve. If you're trying to build like an online portfolio, and if you're trying to, let's say, build an audience for what you do, that's not a clever way to go about this. You should really pick the best one and share that and concentrate on that and work on that and make it as good as you can and then share that and don't share all the 5,000 images that you have.
Yeah.
The chat room says, great tip. My wife needs to learn that one.
Yeah.
There you go. Or you do it Petra style, Petra Cross style, with a really fast.
Right. There are ways to do it in a different way.
Yeah, I mean, if you really have 5,000 pictures of a location, why not do a stop motion?
She makes a video.
Yeah. Yeah.
I love this one. And this is because you teach. Sharing your wisdom, what's obvious to you may be amazing to others. So don't be shy. Share.
Yes.
I like that.
Actually, I have to confess that I stole that from Derek Sivers, and there's a very nice video on YouTube by him, which goes almost by the same name, I think. Obvious to you, amazing to others.
Mm.
But as a, it's very true, because we all have our ideas and we all have ways to solve problems, and they're obvious to us. But it's once when you start sharing them online, when you discover that they're not obvious to everybody. Because that's how I started out. I mean, I was uploading my images to Flickr, and people started getting interested in it, and they were asking me questions about how do you do that, how do you achieve that. And so I decided to start a blog on WordPress, very simple, like 5 minute setup time, and then I was typing in some tutorials about what I thought would may be interesting for people. I actually did that on my honeymoon on a cruise ship. So just like having like 20 minutes and typing in a tutorial and then sharing and seeing what people are saying about it. So, and many people found it very helpful. So for me, it was obvious to do things the way I do them, but many other people said, oh, that really gave me a new idea for solving a problem, or that really showed me a way or a direction to go. So if you have a feeling that there's something in you that you want to share, but you think that, oh, that's so obvious, share it. Go ahead and share it and see how people react.
And tip three, stay true to yourself. We talked a little bit about this.
Yes.
I think this is really hard when you put yourself in the public eye, especially when there's comments. somewhere on Google Plus or Facebook or YouTube.
Yeah, I know. But I think it's important to note or to realize that many people out there are not really...
nice.
You know, people, I was going to put it in another term. So the motivation for giving a negative comment is not always constructive criticism. Right. Some people are just not in a very good mood. They had a bad day and just logging into Google Plus and they're finding an image that may not be what they like about photography, and then off they go. So you will find this on every single page you go on the internet, and you have to avoid letting that into your heart, and to, because it can be very devastating if you get such a comment. And I know that because I was, I'm getting them all the time. So people, I was sharing this tutorial about watermarking a couple of days ago, and it essentially went viral on the internet. So I've had I don't know, 6,000 or 7,000 hits now, and people just plainly say that it's rubbish. It's
that's too bad.
They think it's stupid. They think don't do that to your images. But hey, I mean, it's their opinion.
Right.
I don't go ahead and take the tutorial off of my website because they say that. But it's just an opinion.
I go home and cry at night. But other than that, I.
No, I think it's hard to deal with that when you first get.
Sure.
You know. This type of comments if you're sharing images or something. So don't take everything too serious, the positive and the negative things that you get.
Yeah, I think that's very important because we all get it. I get attacked on a regular basis.
You've built a great website, the Farbspiel-Photo site, and you've got some tips, three tips on building a great website. So first of all, know your audience and build it for them, not you. I like that.
Yeah. So first of all, do you see the subscribe button on my website? Click on that. That's my first tip.
Big blue, you can't miss it.
No, but it's true. I mean, we've been chatting about this in the pre-show chat last week with Catherine, and you know, not every photography website is the same. So it depends on what you're trying to achieve with your site. So if you're a wedding photographer, you may want to have a very big portfolio, a very big slideshow. Oh, you're signing up? That's
of course
great.
I am. I wouldn't want to miss an email.
And then you probably, I mean, you have a different audience than the one that I'm targeting with this website. Because my website is like, let's say, information-driven. I would like to present my images and then also share tutorials, be able to provide ebooks to people. So it's a different purpose than a classical wedding photographer, for example, would have for his website. So knowing for whom you build this is very important. And that also guides you through the selection of a platform, which takes us to tip two.
Choose the right platform. What do you mean like WordPress? What do you mean by that?
Right. So I think you've actually had an advertisement for...
Squarespace.
What's that?
Yeah.
Squarespace.
Yeah.
Right. So there are different tools for building a website. Many, many tools, obviously. And your choice of platform will decide how much pain you have afterwards. So...
that is true.
That's a great way of putting it.
Yes. What are you using, Klaus? Because now you're a computer scientist, so...
It's a little different for you than the masses.
I'm using WordPress.
And that
came naturally because, as I said, when I first started out, I didn't build a website. I just set up a blog. And you can do that with WordPress in like 5 minutes and you're set to go. And then you can, if you discover that that's not enough for your purposes, and I discovered that quite quickly... you can actually rent some web space, download the software for free, and then install it on your web space. And you have thousands of plugins that do different things, thousands of themes that you can use to style your website. So there's a lot of flexibility in it. And that's why I love using WordPress, because you can really continue building it endlessly, and you can extend it in whichever way you like. But obviously, if you really want to get down deep into the dirty bits of it, you have to know some coding. You don't have, it's not necessary to know it, because you can use the off-the-shelf solutions and really get beautiful websites for different purposes. So you can build a wedding photographer website easily with that, using a theme. You can use another theme to build the type of website that I'm building for like information and images. So you can do really everything with it. And you can really go into the details of programming your own extensions if you want to. And of course, being a computer scientist, that's a little bit easier for me than for most other people, probably.
Yeah. Of course, Matt Mullenweg, the guy who started WordPress, did it because he wanted a photo sharing site, and so he wrote the software. So it's not surprising that it's very good, very well adapted to this. And there are lots of themes on this. Let me see how many. 1,546 themes on WordPress.
So if you're planning to build a website, look into that.
Yeah.
If you have a blog, a free blog, you're not very flexible. But if you have web space, your own server, then you can do everything with it.
And your final tip, don't overthink.
Yes. But Leo, that's actually not my final tip.
Okay. There's more?
There's a bonus tip. Yeah. That's the most important.
Yeah.
Have fun with it.
It's clear you're doing that, Klaus. It's great.
And probably the overthinking part is also connected to this final bonus tip, because you know, when you're trying to build a website, it's the danger is that you're trying to make it perfect.
Right.
And nothing is ever perfect. So start out simple. Now get your things together, get your images on there, get a blog running, and then just launch it and show it to people. And then there's time to improve it and to expand it. And if you're having a platform like WordPress, and there may be other platforms where you can do that, extending it is really an incremental process that's not too hard to do. So don't overthink it. Don't try to make it perfect. That pretty much goes for everything in life.
Love your images, Klaus. It's really, really great to see. And again, the website is Farbspiel. I'm going to go back to it now because I've gone through so many sites here. -photo.com.
Right. And if you're interested in the Vaterama stuff, you see there the feature flash, the first box on the left side you have there. I've shown in this little box you have links to some tutorials about Vaterama photography, how to do it handheld. So that's what you're looking at right now is the image. But if you go to the homepage again, just the links in that little box take you to three tutorials that you can follow and that you can try and try out yourself how this works. So it's all free. You can do it. You can practice in your local church if you have one.
Otherwise, your living room. Do a Vaterama of your living room.
Living room is a bit problematic because things are so close to the camera. And if you're doing it handheld, it could be tricky for the stitching.
Anybody can come here to the Brick House studio and do a Vaterama here.
Yeah, this would be a great place.
Yeah, it's almost like a
cathedral. I would love to come. Unfortunately, I'm about 10,000 miles away.
The next time you're
around
in the Bay Area.
I'm going to visit you.
Good, sure. You must. Klaus, such a pleasure meeting you, and really, what a inspiration you are.
Thank you.
Thank you so much,
Klaus, for coming on. And then you mentioned a book, and I have a book for this week.
All right.
A book tip. I'll make it really quick, because I know we're...
No, we're fine. We don't have TNT to kick around anymore.
I know. So, food photography, which is hard to shoot. Food is not... And everyone loves shooting their food. We talked about before. Because you don't have to move, right?
It's right in front of you.
Sits right in front of you. But Nicole Young, she's really active on Google+ as well, and she gives a lot of tutorials and help there. But just this book has been really great for me. And it's really good for any level because it does go over the basics, aperture, shutter speed, all that sort of stuff. But it talks about the more advanced techniques, which are really styling and lighting and how to best get food shots. So this has been a great resource and really, really beautifully well done. Yummy shots throughout, that keep you really hungry?
Mm-hmm.
Lunchtime, Leo?
No, don't show it to me. I haven't eaten yet. No, stop.
So
can I have it?
Yeah.
Yeah, there you go.
It's all yours, Klaus.
My peanut butter and jelly does not look like that. But anyway, I just wanted to say a shout out to Nicole for all the contributions she does. And she has many other books, but this
What's
is the
name?
One that I have. Nicole Young.
Nicole Young.
Yes.
Food photography.
She's known as Nicolezy. That's her social media.
Awesome. And Klaus Herrmann, thank you so much for teaching us how to farbspiel.
Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Thank you all for joining us. We do Twit Photo. At least we'll do it one more time, right, next week.
We have Michael Fry. We're doing landscape photography.
Landscape photography.
So
that'll be 1 p.m. Pacific, 4 p.m. Eastern time on Tuesday. That's 2000 UTC, which means it's real late for Klaus right now. So we're going to let him
go. Yeah, we better let him go to sleep. So we had 4 a.m. starter.
and now
we're ending
with 10 p.m.
10 p.m.
10 or 11.
11.
Thanks for joining us. You can always watch the show. All of the shows are available for download after the fact. At twit.tv/photo?
Yeah.
Photo. twit.tv/photo. And there are 64 episodes. There'll be 65 next week that you can download. And do watch them and share them with your friends, because we're pretty proud of this show. It's been a really wonderful show to do. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next time on Twit Photo.